class. Those aren't written in stone. They obviously change a lot. And if there's a group of people in an area that are fighting for their rights, their identity, for progressive issues, and so on, then it would make sense for socialists to support that fight. But within a federation of other countries moving towards socialism, with a unity of the working class, regardless of how the nation state thing plays out, and with the goal ultimately of, no, the goal ultimately is not nation states. The goal ultimately, not in the short term, unfortunately can't be realized in the short term, but the goal ultimately is a classless, stateless society. You know, you can read, there's a really good book again by Lenin, Vladimir Lenin, one of the leaders of the Russian Revolution, called State and Revolution, where he gets into that. But there's many other basic works of Marxism where, to get to the goal of a society where everyone has a decent life, and more than that, requires a lot of, you know, twists and turns politically that might not seem obvious, including supporting oppressed minorities and impoverished people and or poor people and so on, or not, but just that are being repressed in various ways to form, at least as a transitional thing, form their own state. Anyway, that was a little digression on the right of national self-determination for oppressed minorities. A little Marxist tutorial, very brief. And I didn't mean as a tutorial, by the way. I meant that as just some headlines to go read more about it. But again, we're going to take a quick break with some music, first from David Bowie and then from Leonard Cohen. So we're going highbrow here. We're going intellectual, but I think you'll like it.
I'm a bit of America. I'm a bit of the world. I'm a bit I can't help it. Everybody knows. is dead, but there's gonna be a meter on your bed that will disclose what everybody knows. And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through, from the bloody cross on top of Calvary to the beach in Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows Leonard Cohen. Before that, David Bowie, the late, great David Bowie, great in some ways, with I'm Afraid of Americans. And again, you know, whether Bowie was at all left wing, I don't know. I heard him after he died, there was some stuff about, floating around Facebook, where he was clearly, I think, anti-racist, which is good, obviously. Whether he had a systemic critique of where racism comes from and is perpetuated, I really don't know enough about him. But again, some of his music seems to betray, in my mind, some of it, a sort of left-wing influence. And then I actually saw him in the 90s, I think it was late 90s, maybe early 2000s, with Trent Reznor. Is that his name? Why do I say Reznor? I don't know. You know that. I'm spacing on the band. They were big. They were good. And anyway, that was a good concert. And no evidence of left-wing influence then, but it was a different time. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio, talking music from a working-class, democratic, socialist perspective. Here on WMFO 90.5 FM, Tufts Freeform commercial-free community-based radio, and we are here every Sunday, every other Sunday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. with talk and music, etc. As I said, basically, we are a radio program that is promoting socialism, democratic socialism, and for you to get involved in democratic socialism. And we define that in various ways, most to the point definition of socialism as we perceive it on this program is to bring democracy, real democracy, to the economy on an international scale. And if you do that, if you take the economic decision making of what's going to be produced, how it's going to be produced, how it's going to be distributed out of the hands of the less than 1% internationally that control those decisions in a very autocratic, violent way around the globe, including here in the U.S. If you take that power, that economic power away from that tiny less than 1%, they melt away, they disappear, they have no more power without that economic power, and we can proceed to then make sure everyone has a decent life and create the things we need and want in a way that won't destroy the planet, at least in terms of the planet being fit for human life, global warming and all that. And that's a huge undertaking, and I think society's moving in that direction. And if you read socialist literature, you'll get, even going back to Marx and Engels, the founders of, in some ways, the founders of socialist thought. There's other streams that go into that, other paths there. But basically, even back when Calvinism was just getting going and Marx and Engels and others were analyzing it, they saw that Calvinism tended objectively towards socialism in the sense of socialized production of what before capitalism tended to be more localized, more individualized, although not totally. There were, you know, feudalism and slave systems, of course, had socialized production, also had very coercive states to keep that those systems in place, just like capitalism. And yet, under capitalism, with the superabundance of commodities produced by capitalism, with the technologies developed under capitalism, with socialized production, with most people living in cities now, et cetera, there's sort of an objective trend or tendency towards, you know, the kind of organization that would require international planning, economic planning on a mass, socialized, collective, democratic basis. But things don't, historically, just don't go in this sort of objective march towards what would benefit humanity and the planet best. There are invested interests in keeping things backward and keeping the contradictions of capitalism, again, private ownership and realization of wealth on a mass scale into the hands of the less than 1% versus the creation of that wealth being done by generalized labor and generalized socialized production, ever more concentrated in a lot of ways. So, in most ways. Anyway, without getting back into that totally, this show is basically about how are we going to get to democratic socialism as quickly as possible, as part of that, as efficiently as possible. And the way to do that is to get organized, obviously, and working people need to get organized into a mass socialist movement. And how that gets formed has, you know, many ways of getting formed, radicalized unions, if possible, moving from NGO charitable models to organization, self-organization of working people and youth for, yes, immediate reforms that would help people, but also putting those reforms in the context of fundamental social change so those reforms don't get taken away in the next breath. Right now in the United States, for example, most people actually that are working have lost their pensions. There's no more pension system, guaranteed pension system in the United States. Doesn't exist. A 401k is not a pension. An investment plan is not a pension. A pension is something that you was negotiated mostly by unions, but then also non-union places had to mimic it in order to get workers, get enough workers and so on. And there were laws and so on promoting that if you worked when you retired, the company or companies you worked for would, you would have a pension to help you survive after you retire, because unfortunately Social Security, which should be give you the ability to survive, does not. It's not enough. So in addition to increasing Social Security drastically, and in addition to fighting for pensions, there's these are things that have to happen that are very needed, and people are doing that right now. But the overall pressure, the overall victory, I have to say, of the capitalists is to, within a generation, getting rid of pensions, basically. Getting rid of the, you know, guarantee of an income when you retire. And that's like this huge thing that, you know, of course, doesn't hit younger workers right away. Might not be the top of your list of things to worry about because there's so many things, granted, like just having a job and so on. But it doesn't do us any good to be always be racing to the bottom with our thinking, with our consciousness. You know, like it's a very American thing to be like, oh, it could be worse. You know, at least you have a job, or, you know, oh, it could be worse. What are you complaining about? You're surviving, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's this whole American real dumbing down of political thinking and having people join in the race to the bottom, you know, and then to lie to each other about how great things are, you know? So whenever, for example, on Facebook you see, if it's a page with thousands of subscribers and say it's a union page or a socialist page or something, there's always these trolls that will come in and say basically, well, I don't know, what, you want everything for free? You know, we can, you know, I worked myself through college. I worked my way through college and I gained everything I did through hard work on my own, pulled myself up by my bootstraps, Horatio Alger, blah, 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 blah. And every sociological study that comes down the pike shows social mobility in the United States is worse than any other industrialized country. It's pathetically bad and getting worse. And yet you have the troll will come in and say, well, look at me. I'm the shining example. You know, and then I know people that have this opinion of themselves, and it's so easy to pull apart their pathetic little arguments that they're taught from day one in U.S. schools and so on. And, well, okay, gee, oh, so it was your bootstraps. Those must be interesting bootstraps because who makes bootstraps, for example? I know they mean it metaphorically, but, you know, that's the point. Who wiped your butt and taught you how to talk and eat and dress yourself, and who provided your food? I mean, first of all, Americans are supposed to be in the family, right? So right away, if you say, everything I earned myself, you're just obliterating your family and your extended family that sacrificed massively for you in a country where so many social benefits should be paid for and free, and instead every family, every individual has to fight and scrape to get them together. I can't tell you the tens of thousands of dollars I've spent, my wife and I have spent in childcare, which should have been free, you know? What that did to our ability, our choices, in terms of where we could live and what we could do with our lives and so on. Childcare alone, and then to add elder care and add heating bills, add a million things that should be free or heavily subsidized, and that instead become major hurdles to overcome on a daily basis. That's why so many of us are living paycheck to paycheck, you know? And then the bootstrap crowd comes in and says, oh, you know, I worked really hard, you know? Well, again, I know you people. You're my people. I know you. You're lying to yourself. You've just obliterated your family. You've obliterated your partners and your spouses. You've obliterated the fact that your teachers, you know, this is all a big social construct. You know, living in a society, you know, you can't do it on your own. You know, if you want to take the bootstrap, pull yourself over your bootstraps metaphor to its logical conclusion, you should be growing your own food and making your own clothes and you know, working for yourself and not getting hired by anybody, and then not living off the labor of others. You know. Anyway, we could go on and on with that, how somehow all the social connections and all the exploitation of other people's labor and all the favors and help and subsidize this and that disappears when somebody is intent on proving to the world that they did everything on their own, you know? It's a bunch of crap. Anyway, let's get a little more into some data on the election. It's not directly about the elections, most of it, but it's about things happening around the elections. Again, context for the current elections. If you're wondering, you know, where this is coming from, both in terms of class anger that Sanders is tapping into, also I have to say some class anger that Trump, unfortunately, is tapping into, etc. Anyway, I don't know if you came across this, but millennials, quote unquote, millennials are well educated and paid like, and then there's a swear word I'm not allowed to say over the air. According to the Center for American Progress, 30-year-olds today make about as much on average as 30-year-olds did in 1984. Quote, despite the fact that the facts that they are 50% more likely to have finished college and that they work in an economy that is 70% more productive. And you're going to see why this is relevant in a second, because I'm going to get into, as quickly as possible, again, youth attitudes towards socialism. The Center for American Progress lays out the way the economic downturn, slow recovery, and student debt have canceled out today's record workforce productivity and levels of higher education in the United States. Wages rose slightly in the mid-2000s, but have dipped again. The median overall hourly wage for a 30-year-old in 1984 was $18.99 per hour. In 2004, it was $20.63. In 2014, it's back down to $19.32, essentially the same as in 84. This stagnation is due to a perpetually loose market in which supply has been higher than demand for a long time, and the fact that there are few non-public unions to protect people who are working. The study notes that employers raise wages only when they are required to. The last few decades show that they do not raise wages simply out of generosity. The Center for American Progress notes that the playing field between employees and employers will have to be leveled by keeping interest rates low as to not, well, anyway, it gets into all this stuff that's not really going to do much. It actually doesn't get into a lot of stuff. It just mentions interest rates. Okay, well, so anyway, that's, you know, that this is not a, it was from the Atlantic, that Atlantic Monthly, this article. It's not going to really get into revolution, socialist revolution, or anything else useful, unfortunately. And I'm not saying every article has to end with socialist revolution for it to have useful reforms listed. This particular article just doesn't. Another article to check out, again, for context, why would the youth be embracing socialism? Why are so many people embracing socialism or their version of it? A quote, with so much poverty hidden in plain sight, you have to ask, is this still America? This is from Sunday, March 20th, 2016. And it's from, didn't print out who's this from. I've complained about this before on air. It's like, you know, with all the technology out there, they can't make sure that their brand gets into the, you know, when you hit print, print copy. Anyway, whatever. Last week in America, I was one of the countries most celebrated, in one of the most countries celebrated tourist spots. I'm quoting here, renowned for its natural beauty, etc. And where are we going here with this? I had this sussed out here, and now I'm losing my way. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to go into this one for time reasons, especially a lot of personal anecdote stuff working into the general poverty rates. About someone traveling around America from another country. Coming in 2008, I will quote this, coming into 2008, the economy and the middle class slide into poverty was a big election issue. Unemployment was 7.8% when Obama took office in 2009. It reached a 10%, high of 10% that same year. Millennials were being crushed by massive student loan debts and abysmal employment prospects. George Packer's brilliant book, The Unwinding, captured that moment in time. The middle class was sinking, etc. And yet the Obama administration hasn't really improved that, etc. So, yeah, that's an article. They were trying to give some context for the elections as well. By the way, have you... Well, okay, let me jump into these Washington Post articles I mentioned earlier that, again, these are op-ed, these are opinion pages, but the fact that the Washington Post would resort to printing them at all is interesting. They're all from March, one's from the 21st, one's from the 23rd, one's from the 24th. First, and they're all well-known, at least to me, well-known alternative media socialist writers types, or at least two of them are, John Bellamy Foster, who we've talked about on the show before, and Sean McElwee. All right, anyway, first one from March 21st, Christine Emba. Let's see if they say who Christine Emba is here towards the end. Nope. Okay. Oh yeah, editor of In Theory. All right. So anyway, she writes this article that's entitled "Our Socialist Youth: Why Millennials Are Embracing a Bad Old Term." And a quote, this is pretty funny, "The latest, greatest aphrodisiac on college campuses across the nation is socialism? According to Fox News pollster Frank Luntz, asked recently about the sudden revival of the political ideology, quote, if you are a young person, you tell someone of the opposite sex that you are a socialist, you are much more likely to get some action at the end of the evening, unquote. Though pundits may disapprove, it seems that socialism is cool. Apparently a whiff of Marxism can get you hookups and more." So that's interesting. I wasn't gonna read that, but it's like, okay, so the public, that's the best the Fox News can do. doing organizing on a college campus, I can say that that is not the main reason people are interested in socialism. But hey, that seems to be a theme in like bourgeois superficial analysis of why someone would get involved in socialism. I mean, remember Woody Allen, for example, in some of his movies would repeat this old thing. And I've seen it repeated in many films and so on, where the dramas, where the main thing isn't sort of any serious analysis, but just in passing, I joined the Communist Party because there were a lot of women involved and I thought I could, you know, meet some or something like that. And I'm putting it nicely. It's usually more crude than that. And I'm like, where does this come from as analysis about why someone would join the Communist Party? I mean, that's just insane, of course. And a party, whether it's the Communist, even the Stalinists in the Communist Party, had certain standards, you know? I mean, like, so, yeah, the idea that, people get involved in socialism for meeting people and stuff for hookups, quote-unquote, is just not true. Anyway, let's see. Socialism does, so this is the author, socialism does seem to have become the political orientation du jour among voters of a certain, read, young age. As its popularity has grown, the response from older, poorly wiser politicos has been fascinating. First, mainly dismissiveness, then confusion, and now the Bernie Sanders campaign, etc. And so far, the Democratic presidential primary, 1.5, this was written again March 21st, 1.5 million people under 30 have voted for Sanders, so she's going into the whole Sanders as socialist thing, or perception of Sanders as socialist. Then, of course, the point, most young voters did not live through the Cold War, so for many millennials, they didn't go through that brainwashing. She doesn't say that. That's my term. But one thing interesting about this is that how perceptions can change rather quickly. So, for example, since 2008, the right has waged war against Barack Obama with what it thought were obviously damaging terms. He's a raging leftist, a communist organizer, etc. Obamacare is socialist, all these things that, of course, Obama was not. But didn't really work. That's interesting, okay? And that's the point she's making in general. The past 10 years, for many millennials, the formative years of adulthood have eroded the credibility of economic liberalism, according to the author. The financial crisis and recession weakened youth's faith in markets, exposed deep levels of inequality, and alerted many young people to the fact that their futures were likely to be far less brighter than their parents were at the same age. Far less bright than their parents were at the same age. Yet they were also told that the solution to these problems was more liberal capitalism. But those solutions haven't delivered. And the failure to do so, the most fundamental political influence of our time, is the most fundamental, perhaps the most political fundamental political influence of our time. Underemployment, excessive debt, out-of-reach health care, and delayed life goals are young people's defining concerns. And the traditional assumption that, quote, free markets, and I'm adding the quote here because no such thing, and limited state intervention led to good outcomes just doesn't ring true to them. If is it any wonder that young people seek answers elsewhere, and with the term sundered from its negative antecedents and newly associated with potentially positive policy measures, why not be a socialist? Etc. And she goes into how that can be defined in certain ways. Let's see. She goes back into some cliches about socialism and mentions it's being redefined as sort of a liberal thing along the lines of FDR. And I think that's true for some, but she's way too presumptuous about everyone, obviously, or about the generality. She doesn't have any more evidence than anyone else that perhaps some people are defining, or a great number of people are defining socialism as something to the left of FDR and what she calls earlier in that article liberal capitalism. Is democratic socialism the American dream? Another Washington Post op-ed piece, March 23rd, John Bellamy Foster. Now, John Bellamy Foster is a real socialist. He is editor of Monthly Review, an independent socialist magazine. And he said in this article, is democratic socialism the American dream? He goes into some things that, you know, a lot of people are talking about. The 400 richest billionaires in the country now have more wealth than the bottom half of income earners, representing some 150 million people. The share of wages in national income has been falling while property income has been increasing. Jobs are more precarious. Vast numbers of people have dropped out of the labor force, things I actually mentioned earlier in the show, actually. Although official unemployment has decreased in the past few years, good jobs paying livable wages remain extremely hard to come by. And another point we made earlier, more people are falling into poverty. A majority of students in public schools are now classified as poor or near poor. The political establishment, consisting of the duopoly of the Democratic and Republican parties, has been largely oblivious to the deteriorating conditions of the majority of people. Since the poor, including the working poor, are much less likely to vote and have little financial clout, they are easily discounted. Money dominates U.S. politics at every level. The Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision, which opened the floodgates to unrestricted large donations from the corporate rich, has enormously tarnished the image of American democracy. It is now common to hear that the United States is, to quote the memorable phrase of economists Paul Barron and Paul Sweezy in 1966, economists Barron and Sweezy, quote, democratic in form and plutocratic in content. Yeah, no kidding. So, then he talks about Sanders portraying himself as a democratic socialist in the mold of the most radical phase of the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration. More about Sanders. What is most remarkable about the Sanders phenomenon is that despite unrelenting hostility from the media gatekeepers of the status quo, for example, the Washington Post ran 16 negative stories about Sanders within 16 hours on March 8th. He has continued to draw record crowds, etc. So he goes into the perception of Sanders as being socialist. He talks about, at the end, how Sanders sort of redefining that some tenets of democratic socialism as basically part of the American dream. And finally, by Sean McElwee, March 24th, again, part of this series of op-ed pieces in the Washington Post, in itself interesting that it got in there. Of course, the vast majority of stuff in the Post is just always relentlessly pro-capitalist. McElwee writes often for Counterpunch. He's a research associate at Demos. Demos, relentlessly, last time I checked, Demos was just a front for the Democratic Party. It was really funny. I actually exchanged some emails with I wrote something that the editor at Demos really liked. So he's like trying to find out more about me, and I have this stupid Harvard email address because I work there. So a lot of people, a lot of social climbers, liberals and so on, they see that address and they start salivating. So he writes to me, blah, 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 you know, asking me, veiled questions about who I am, what I do, and all that kind of stuff. And I just said, hey, wait a minute, dude. You know, I basically work for a living. I work at this place. I don't go here to school. And I'm a revolutionary socialist. I'm in a group called Socialist Alternative. Blah, blah. That correspondence stopped. Boom. The gate came down. Boom. I thought it was great. I'm glad. I don't have time to waste with liberals. In that sense, I would gladly waste time with liberals in a discussion about, getting involved with the socialist movement and getting involved with various activities and campaigns and so on and so forth. This guy was just like hunting for, I don't know, someone to work on Demos or something, which I would rather, chew glass. But anyway, the kids these days are doing fine. If you think socialism is fine, this is again quoting Sean McElwee. According to a recent YouGov poll, 43% of those ages 18 to 29 have a favorite. Ah, here we go. YouGov. That's a poll I have not cited in recent shows over the last year or so. So a YouGov poll, 43% of those 18 to 29 have a favorable view of socialism compared with 23% of those over 65. Now but think about that. 23% of over 65, that's pretty good too. You know what I mean? Compared to what you would think. Compared to what people were certainly thinking 10, 15, 20 years ago. 23% over 65 believing in socialism, that's something to work with. Because only 26% of young people had an unfavorable view, the rest had no preference. Respondents under 30 were the only group more likely to report a positive view of socialism, that's majority-wise, than a negative view. But, he goes on to say, I'm still quoting, this isn't a simple youthful flirtation with supposedly radical views. Labels aside, there's something deeper going on. An analysis of the national survey data reveals that on core issues of the role of government, young people are significantly more pro-government than their parents. So he's basically going into these other things that he thinks suggest a deeper interest in aspects of socialism. And that's an important thing to do. So I'm not surprised. He's written well, this guy in Counterpunch. So this is a very good angle to take here. to, rather than like Foster, who I like, I mean, John Bradley Foster, I like his stuff, but he's just saying, oh, Sanders equals more, a perception, at least, he hasn't used the word, I'm using it, perception of more support for socialism, the Sanders phenomena. Nah, yes and no. That's changing even as we speak of it. I think word is getting out that Sanders isn't really a socialist and that he's redefining it in certain ways, but for, of course, many, many more people, it's just maybe an introduction. They heard that word associated with him. McElwee here is taking a deeper approach, which I really like, but I don't have time to read all the different things. He goes on with the government role. Let's jump in here also, though. For older Americans, socialism and capitalism evoked the Cold War animus between the United States and the Soviet Union. But data suggests that for young Americans, capitalism, quote-unquote, is a stand-in for the reckless system that created the financial crisis, while socialism, quote-unquote, brings to mind the social democracy practiced by Nordic countries. Then we go back to that thing again, which, if you remember, Sanders was asked, you know, at different times during his campaign what he sees as socialism, and often he'll bring out this, what's in the Scandinavian countries is socialism. Well, it's not at all. It's capitalism. It's actually, if you know anything about the conditions in Sweden, Norway, Denmark, etc., yes, they have a higher standard of living than the United States. They have a better social welfare system, but people fought hard for that. In the post-war upswing, it was a combination of the U.S. trying to subsidize these economies to a certain extent to keep them out of being too influenced from the capitalist point of view, the U.S., of socialist alternatives or Stalinism, unfortunately. People fought like heck to organize unions to the point where they were in Sweden at 1.93% unionization, where they had multiple political parties, including radical political parties, nominally socialist, communist, and so on, still exist there. It wasn't like, you know, if you go back to Scandinavia in the 1930s, it was just dirt poor, just like the United States, you know? It was the fight during the 30s, into World War II even, and afterwards, that the social welfare systems were built up, which are now, by the way, under attack. And there's right-wing movements there. There's anti-immigrant sentiment there. The Nordic countries are not a model for socialists. They are simply, for historical reasons, and including a more vibrant socialist movement, they are at a higher level of living standards and so on right now. That has been weakening, that has been declining, and is continuing to decline. Even Norway, which got a big boost from oil money in the 2000s, now that that's, over the last couple of years, gone down, you see mass protests happening in Norway as the capitalists go to cut jobs and cut social welfare and so on based on the lower oil prices in, to a certain extent. Let's see. We're looking at Scott McElwee's article, see if there's anything else you want to throw in there. No, we'll leave it at that, but that's worth checking out. Also, I wanted to point our listeners out to John Pilger. Pilger is a Australian journalist, radical journalist. I think he lives in London now. I'm not sure, but in any case, he will come out with some things that will really challenge the narratives that are dominant at a given moment. You know, even on the left, even from the liberal so-called alternative media to a certain extent, and. So apparently he gave a talk recently at the University of Sydney entitled A World War Has Begun. And, you know, I read this because I respect Pilger's work. He often doesn't connect all the dots up. I don't know what he does in terms of activism, if anything. But one thing about him is he just doesn't forget, you know, certain things. So he starts off talking about something that doesn't get noticed anymore, for the most part, but the threat of nuclear war in the world. He brings up some history. For example, 66 nuclear devices were exploded by the United States in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958, the equivalent of 1.6 Hiroshima bombs every day for 12 years. Then he goes and visits the island, sees how the people are living. But this is all leading up to a point, and basically he's talking about U.S. politics right now. So, for example, again, this is leading up to that, but in 2009, quoting Pilger, President Obama stood before an adoring crowd in the center of Prague, in the heart of Europe. He pledged himself to make, quote, the world free from nuclear weapons, unquote. People cheered. Some even cried. A torrent of platitudes flowed from the media. Obama was subsequently awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. It was all fake. He was lying. That's Pilger. That's the kind of powerful prose he can write. He also does a lot of documentary films and so on. Quoting Pilger again, the Obama administration has built more nuclear weapons, more nuclear warheads, more nuclear delivery systems, more nuclear factories. Nuclear warhead spending alone rose higher under Obama than under any American president. The cost over 30 years is more than $1 trillion. A mini-nuclear bomb is planned. It is known as the B-61 Model 12. There's never been anything like it. General James Cartwright, a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has said, quote, going smaller makes this nuclear weapon more thinkable. Makes using this nuclear weapon more thinkable. In the last 18 months, the greatest buildup of military forces since World War II, led by the United States, is taking place along Russia's western frontier. Not since Hitler invaded the Soviet Union have foreign troops presented such a demonstrable threat to Russia. The Ukraine, once part of the Soviet Union, has become a CIA theme park. Having orchestrated a coup in Kiev, Washington effectively controls a regime that is right next door and hostile to Russia, a regime rotten with Nazis, literally. Prominent parliamentary figures in Ukraine are the political descendants of the notorious OUN and UPA fascists. They openly praise Hitler and call for the persecution and expulsion of the Russian-speaking minority. Now, this is seldom news in the West, or it is inverted to suppress the truth. In Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, right next door to Russia, the U.S. military is deploying combat troops, tanks, heavy weapons. This extreme provocation of the world's second nuclear power is met with silence in the West. What makes the prospect of nuclear war even more dangerous is a parallel campaign against China. Seldom a day passes when China is not elevated to the status of a, quote, threat, unquote. And then he goes on to talking about how the media has been treating China. And I like the way he just puts everything on its head and says, you know, this is some very, very important context. He goes, I made a film called The War, context for the elections, even though this stuff's being ignored in the elections, this for kind of obvious foreign policy, push by U.S. imperialism against Russia and anyone else they might in China and they might perceive as rivals. I made a film called The War You Don't See. This is quoting Pilger again, in which I interviewed distinguished journalists in America and Britain. Reporters such as Dan Rather of CBS or Rage Omar of the BBC, David Rose of The Observer. All of them said that journalists and broadcasters had done their jobs and questioned the propaganda that Saddam Hussein possessed mass weapons of mass destruction at the time of the Iraq War or before it. Had the lies of George W. Bush, Tony Blair not been amplified and echoed by journalists, the 2000 invasion of Iraq might not have happened, and hundreds of thousands of men and women and children would be alive today. The propaganda laying the groundwork for war against Russia and or China is no different in principle. To my knowledge, no journalist in the Western mainstream, asks why China is building airstrips in the South China Sea. The answer ought to be glaringly obvious. The United States is encircling China with a network of bases, with ballistic missiles, battle groups, nuclear-armed bombers, etc. So it's a whole thing. And then he gets into the campaign. I'm not sure, what the segue is there. But he starts talking about Trump. And so he goes, again, putting this in a different perspective than you're used to hearing about. He says, Trump is being presented as a lunatic, a fascist. He is certainly odious. But he's also a media hate figure, Pilger points out. This alone should arouse our skepticism. Trump's views on migration are grotesque, but no more grotesque than those of David Cameron, who's the current Prime Minister of Britain. It's not Trump who is the great deporter from the United States, but the Nobel Prize winner, Barack Obama. Now, he doesn't go to repeat this, but as you have probably read or heard, or some of our listeners, the Obama administration has deported more immigrants than any other in U.S. history. So then he basically goes on to talking about American foreign policy in the context, again, of the elections, Clinton's record being very quite horrible, obviously. For example, quote, in 2008 presidential, in the 2008 presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton threatened to totally obliterate, quote unquote, Iran with nuclear weapons. As Secretary of State under Obama, she participated in the overthrow of the Democratic government of, of Honduras. Her contribution to the destruction of Libya in 2011 was almost gleeful, et cetera. Yeah, so again, context for the election is from the standpoint of foreign policy. And let's see. He even goes into Clinton a little bit, although that's not his main thing. Today, he goes, quote, today the long sleep may be over. The young are stirring again, gradually. The thousands in Britain who supported Jeremy Corbyn as Labour leader are part of this awakening, as are those who rallied to support Senator Bernie Sanders. In Britain last week, Jeremy Corbyn's closest ally, his shadow treasurer, John McDonnell, committed a Labour government to paying off the debts of the piratical banks and, in effect, to continue austerity. In the U.S., Bernie Sanders has promised to support Clinton if or when she's nominated. And he too, meaning Bernie Sanders, has voted for America's use of violence against countries which he thinks it's quote-unquote right to do so. He says Obama has done, quote, a great job, unquote. So, again, you know, what has happened to the great, he finishes, what has happened to the great tradition of popular direction unfettered to parties? Where's the courage, imagination, commitment to begin the long journey to a better, just, and peaceful world? Where are the dissidents in art, film, theater, and literature? Where are those who will shatter the silence, or do we wait for the first nuclear missile to be fired? So, yeah, I don't know. I think there is some obvious dissidence out there, and not just silence, but he's making a point. He's maybe exaggerating for effect a little bit. And we've only got about two more minutes where we have to start wrapping up. So I'm going to point this article out. Don't have time to go into it, but it's something I noticed and was like, really, there was this point in the corporate media a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, where all of a sudden there seemed to be a wholesale attack on the idea of free college education, which, of course, has been, you know, in, with public schools, which, of course, Sanders talked about, but it was talked about prior to Sanders and actually has existed at times. I mean, CUNY, due to the mass movement in the 60s and 70s, the CUNY system in New York was free for a time. It's not totally unheard of. And all of a sudden, all these arguments were coming out about how it's actually somehow better for rich people and worse for working class people to have free college. And I'm like, I still don't understand their arguments. I mean, I understand their arguments from their point of view and the so-called message that they're putting forward, but it's still completely, at the end of the day, completely nonsensical. So for example, this is from Fair and Actually in reporting. There's like this, a lot of quotes, including this guy, Matt Iglesias at Vox, who's a liberal, 3/10/16 in true neoliberal fashion, according to the author. He considers mean tested higher education, quote, more progressive, praises the strength. Let's see. Clinton's plan seems to like it. Wait a minute. I don't know. I thought that was going to be against it. That was what I, maybe that, maybe he's ending up with some that are for it. So anyway, there's all these really interesting quotes. Check it out. Fairness and Action Media, March 15, 2016. And finally, another article worth checking out is Aaron Gupta, Telesur, March 23rd. Sanders campaign actually talks about Socialist Alternative, makes some good points about Sanders. In Socialist Alternative's website, socialalternative.org, The Dialectical Legacy of Richard Levins, 1930 to 2016, ecologist Richard Levins passed away in January, etc. Article by George Brown, very much worth looking at on the website, socialalternative.org. And I'm going to have to pretty much leave it at that. There is this article, mildly good, pretty good actually, because it kind of goes against the grain right now, by Jack Metzger from March 15th. In These Times, quote, how the media gets the narrative on the white working class totally wrong. And what he goes into there, actually using facts and figures and so on, about how the idea that the U.S. White working class is in lockstep behind Trump, a severe oversimplification to say the least, and he proves that in various ways. So that's worth reading. And I'm sorry we're running out of time here. You have been listening to Socialist Alternative Radio. Again, go to Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. For more information, go to socialistalternative.org on the web and various other ways to interact with us. But the point is, if you heard anything today that kind of captured your imagination or got you a little angry or curious, get involved with socialism. Become a member of Socialist Alternative. Become a member of the socialist movement, so to speak. Member is a weird term maybe to use. If you're one of these, I'll make an appeal here that I hope doesn't sound too hostile. But if you're one of these, quote, independent socialists, unquote, get over yourself. There's no such thing as an independent socialist, because socialism, by definition, is collective action to change society, or part of the definition of socialism, at least in terms of an activist angle, is to work with other workers and youth to change society. And the best way to do that is, of course, in an organization and not just out on your own. So that's all we have time for. We're going to go out with The Clash, Magnificent Seven. If you don't hear the end of the song because it gets cut off, check it out for yourself. It's good stuff. And thanks for listening. We'll be back in a couple weeks. Cheese boy got